Hi, I'm Mike Sainsbury and welcome to this ASI cast, where Brian Jacobs is interviewing John Wilkins, chairman of the creative agency Karmarama. The interview was conducted before the WFA Global Marketer Conference held recently in Tokyo, at which John was speaking, and which saw the launch of the association's Global Media Charter, outlining the 8 principles for partnership needed to reform the digital ad ecosystem. Brian and John discuss the main concerns advertisers are seeking to address and how, far from acting as an obstacle and a hindrance, the ready availability of data can act as essential fuel for the creative process to flourish.
Okay, so hello everybody, this is Brian Jacobs, and today on this ASI cast we are joined by John Wilkins, who's the chairman of a creative agency in the UK known, I'm sure, by many of you, called Karmarama. So hi there, John.
Hello there.
So, John, we're delighted you're able to join us to discuss a few sort of hot topics, as it were, around the advertising and media worlds at the moment. So maybe we could begin on the whole matter of sort of very public advertiser involvement in media-related matters, as it were. So obviously, recapping a couple of years ago, we had the big ANA inquiry into transparency in the US. Then we obviously had the famous speech of almost 18 months ago now, I think it was, from Mark Pritchard of Procter, and then subsequent other speeches by various other people and contributions from people like the World Federation of Advertisers. Now, I know you do quite a lot of work advising the WFA, although I appreciate not exactly on this precise topic. But what is your sort of take on where we've got to and on the progress being made since these interventions first came to light?
Yeah, well, I think there's two or three interconnected sort of trends, I guess, that I've seen progress in following this. One would be around sort of code of conduct, ethics, best practice, and certainly the WFA that you mentioned are doing their very best to sort of synchronize the global client's response to this. So, they've looked at a number of suggested best practices, both internally with third parties and indeed with platforms around transparency, auditing, measurement, and any number of things they can do to just sort of slightly clean up the murkiness. So that would be one. I think the second trend I've seen is at the heart of this debate, if you strip away some of the practices, is the issues around data and use of first party, second party, and third party data. And obviously, this has come to light even more presciently with sort of Cambridge Analytica and some of the recent news. But actually, even without that, I think with GDPR, what we've seen is a lot of clients really sort of thinking through the where they hold that data, who, if anyone, they share that data with, and how they use that to appropriately target personalized messages. And so the knock-on effect into, I guess, the broader agenda would be starting to see clients looking at things like in-housing certain elements of data and content management, looking at sort of DMP, certainly programmatic management in-house. We're starting to see that as a trend, and quite a few clients have kind of gone, actually, you know, we weren't too trusting before the whole issues around transparency came up, but now we're more fearful because of the potential legal ramifications of misuse of data and targeting. So as I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, you know, it's not just whether client X uses their data inappropriately. If a supplier of client X or a partner of client X uses their data inappropriately, the punitive fines ladder back to the parent company. And, you know, certainly the share of revenue fine that is stipulated in a lot of the legal documentation is scary and huge. So, you know, you've also got legal departments crawling all over this as well. So, yeah, you know, definitely. So in answer to your question, sort of definitely a regulatory best practice push, and then definitely some stuff around data. And then the third one I was going to mention is probably the clunkiest sort of response, or the least clear, is what a client's going to do about the platforms, you know, because on the one hand, they've sort of started to see some questionable practices, whether it's, the Facebook Analytica challenge. I'm sure there's more that's going to come out of the locker there. I can't believe that they've even scratched the surface of that. But at the same time, they've got these very symbiotic relationships with these platforms. So, you know, I think the official line from the WFA is something like, obviously, we're disappointed, blah, 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 but we still see them as critical partners, so we want to work with them to resolve these issues. And, you know, I think that's, I don't know, I don't really, I'm not really sure that's going to get to the bottom of the problem.
You make a very good point about data, and for those of our listeners that don't know, Karma Rama, as a creative agency, was acquired by Accenture, you know, a fairly significant purchase and move into this space by Accenture. And obviously Accenture is a business that's got pretty amazing capabilities and understanding and using data in every sense and across a whole range of sectors and businesses. Do you think, I mean, looking at it, I mean, you're obviously sitting there in a creative agency, do you reckon that creative agencies generally, I don't mean you particularly, but do you think creative agencies generally have really yet grasped how data can sort of drive creative concepts? I mean, beyond just optimization and kind of some kind of sort of tactical execution. I mean, are people starting to use data better in briefings and upstream thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. And I think, sadly, probably not enough at the moment. I think that's sort of predicated on sort of, you know, the divide that's taken place right down the middle of sort of marketing practice, where you've seen sort of the growth of performance marketing and programmatic and data-driven, results-oriented optimization, sort of almost breaking away from, brand and creative and communication. And I think, you know, this whole, you know, there's been a debate running for the last couple of years around this divide and, you know, is anybody going to attempt to put this back together? You know, creative agencies of note in the UK have called this divide the divide between culture and collateral, and many creative companies have said, you know, it's our primary role to put brands into culture, and to be honest, the collateral stuff, even privately, is a little bit grubby and not very creative. And so I think, you know, there are problems. I think the creative community generally has sort of sat back and gone, it's a divide not of our making, it's a marketing divide. Our allies are on the brand side. We find the sort of programmatic analytical space fiddly, not very creatively rewarding, so we're not going to go there. And I think that's a little bit of a shame, because I think almost inevitably the left and the right brain of the marketing function and performance and persuasion, if you like, are going to have to come back together, partly because I think consumers are going to demand it. You know, we're already seeing quite a lot of rejection of targeted poor quality messages, with consumers sort of saying, look, I need a little bit more respect. If you're going to personalize, then at least do it with intent, creativity and passion. So I think consumers have sort of swung the pendulum back into clients and said, how are you going to connect this together? So I mean, from our point of view, and I can only really give you our point of view, we see data fired in the right direction as fuel for creativity. And what I really mean by that, and this is sort of probably coming out of a market research background like a lot of your listeners, that data really is just another more fluid live form of marketing research. And actually what we try and do is we try and use sort of live behavioral data patterns to sort of aggregate trends to really drive creative processes. And, you know, I mean, we've done that on any number of clients, but one that's been of quite high profile in the UK is the recruitment campaign for the British Army that we've been involved in. And what we found actually looking at the conversations around joining the army, looking at the way successful applicants navigated the recruitment process, looking at the advice they were given, using, as I say, data, really just as a sort of way of garnering insight, we actually found there were some very interesting insights that we managed to ladder up into any number of creative briefs. So we could almost anticipate triggers and barriers and build really convincing creative work around it. So we're a fan of driving data into the creative process. And I think that is a sort of slight pivot, moving data away from fine-tuning and optimizing of, you know, response, really into fine-tuning and optimizing message. And we're hoping and believing that that change has to come because consumers are going to demand it and marketers are going to have to deliver it.
Yeah, I mean, the opportunity is huge, isn't it? I mean, if more agencies or creative agencies particularly, I mean, I think media agencies seem to have kind of grasped this, maybe not always to best advantage and maybe not always to the best, leading to the best creative work at the end of it all. But if creative agencies could start to, as you say, sort of build data into the further up the briefing process, so people, just the same way as they do with, as you say, with market research and, you know, and insights generated by research of whatever type. It's just another form of research, isn't it? I mean, it's just...
That's right. And I mean, you know, there was, I remember like 3 or 4 years ago, a lot of creatives felt that data, because they saw performance marketing as a creative straitjacket, you know, where you started getting into the minutiae of font size and offer and color Pantone and, you know, different types of models. And, you know, it really felt like it was... The noodly end of creative and one that not many originators of ideas would want to get involved in. But I think what our guys have certainly seen is that creative use of data can be incredibly liberating. And, you know, what creatives want is they want powerful, motivating insights that they can, you know, harness the foundational big thought around, you know, so in the army, it's this is belonging is the big thought. And then within that, you know, being able to say, and, you know, there's 10, 15 different triggers and barriers or opportunities that we can then leverage different communication around. They see that as actually a really interesting, you know, extension, if you like, of the creative footprint that they can make. Because looking at it from a creative point of view, you know, the one thing the creatives across the world, I would say, are worried about nowadays is, you know, increasingly being given very channel-specific, almost project-oriented briefs where the phone rings and the client wants a 30-second TV commercial or, you know, some posters. And creatives find that very, you know, very confining. So my thing, really, when I talk to creatives, is data is a sort of liberation for you. It allows you to be more expressive with ideas. It also allows us, done well, to, you know, batch up and produce a hell of a lot more content at the same time. So another example would be, say, the work we did for the Euros with the World Cup coming up. It reminded me, which was around Unibet, who are an international gambling platform. And, you know, they said, look, you know, basically their entire business is data fueled, obviously being an online gambling platform. But they said, look, you know, we've got 1 month that makes or breaks our business in terms of these big tournaments. We know every single fixture. We know the weather. We know the topography. We know the teams. We know the history. We know who's good at penalties. We know which teams play well on in rain. We know, you know, we know the backgrounds, all of these local. So why could we not, you know, use the data that we already have to batch up a much vaster quantity of content so we can be, you know, in the moment with appropriate messaging? And our creatives love that. And, you know, what we actually ended up doing, I think from memory, was creating around 750 different units of creative content at the same time that were almost flat planned like a good old-fashioned magazine. You know, we had a wall down the back of the office where we had the whole tournament laid out. We had every scenario. So the Germans get a penalty. Well, crikey, the Germans always score in penalties. So when that literally happens, what piece of content do we release into the media world to show that we've got a point of view on that precise moment? And again, you know, just using data, you know, to be topical and relevant, slightly different to using it for concrete insight, but using that in advance to batch up and create a hell of a lot more content, again, worked tremendously well for that business. And again, creatively was really interesting for us as a company. So I think it's more about just being positive about it, not seeing it as all about performance and all about fine-tuning of fonts, and to sort of try and look at the potential, because it is the market research fuel of the future. I mean, let's be honest, I'm not discrediting syndicated service or qualitative research, because we still use that as well. But when you've got live, substantive, quantitative pools of data that really, really stack up, why would you not use that to drive original thinking? You
know? Exactly. Well, maybe we could move off of data for a moment, and just again, for the benefit of those listeners that don't know this. I mean, John, you started a business. I've lost track of how many years ago. Quite a long time ago.
2000, yes,
quite a long time. No, really, okay. Called Naked, in London, which really completely changed the way that sort of media agencies started to think about strategic comms planning. I mean, they, you know, Naked was obviously, this was your focus, this is what the business did, and a lot of the agencies really had to adapt their models and attempt to see off this challenger, as it were. So, I mean, nowadays, I mean, when you look around, so I know you're from a media and research background originally, but if you look around you at sort of today's media agencies, who obviously have changed quite considerably in the last 20 odd years, I mean, what do you see? What do you make of them?
Well, I think the original premise behind Naked was really about bringing objectivity to the heart of decision making, and also about harnessing, you know, the broadest gamut of channels that were possible for a client to create competitive advantage. So, you know, I've seen, you know, that type of service has really, you know, and I think there was sort of two directions for a business like Naked to go. One was to sort of move into marrying that to execution, and the other one was really to move that communication strategy skill more upstream. So, you know, you have seen businesses that have taken the core philosophy of Naked and moved it upstream into consulting and combined sort of change management and, you know, helping marketing departments to structure themselves accordingly. And, you know, there's a number of those that are flourishing. I mean, Flock would be one that comes to mind, where, you know, the core premise is really about strategic communications advice, but they've managed to move it into the marketing organization. You know, they help clients run pitches, make the right choices, et cetera, et cetera. I think in the media agency space, really, what sort of subsequently happened, I think, was there was a few agencies that sort of harnessed that sentiment and tried to then build in, I guess, almost objective buying off the back of it. And that is quite boutique and quite niche, because the whole market, as we know, in the media space was really about, you know, chasing volume and, you know, if anything, working at, you know, very, very low commission rates to get things done. And I think the one thing that I've seen in the independent media landscape currently, which I think is a value that's shared with Naked, is a lot of the independents have taken a strong position on sort of transparency and trust, certainly in the UK. And, you know, they may not be entirely objective across paid, earned and owned, because that's a very broad spectrum of channels and one that extends almost by the day or by the week. But what they are doing is they're saying another side of objectivity is really the foundation of trust. And the foundation of trust is really everything we do on behalf of you is for you and you alone. And, you know, that questions some of the sort of, I guess, the big institutionalized media companies that have
really sort of stockpiled inventory, you know, a la Walmart, and bought it at the best prices and then are reselling it on. And within marketplaces like that, you do have to question, you know, at its fundament, whether a client always gets what a client always deserves. So, you know, there are still, I still think the debate is valid. I just think that the sort of business model is challenging for just an impartial advisor unless you go upstream or somehow you tether it to impartiality of decisions in media marketplaces.
It's a very good point. Well, John, as always, it's a great pleasure to talk to you and to hear your views about these matters. And so thanks very much indeed for joining us on this ASI podcast.
It's a great pleasure. All the very best.
Cheers.